Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This evening, we turn to a very important and very central concept in the objectivist ethics, namely, the virtue of justice. This is the one virtue in the objectivist ethics which specifically is a social virtue, by which I mean the one virtue that specifically pertains to men's relationship with one another. Justice is the virtue that the majority of men pay lip service to, but only a rare minority practice. Why? Because justice pertains to one's judgment, not of nature, but of men. Justice is incompatible with the conventional ethics of altruism. It is incompatible with the creed of self-sacrifice. And by the same token, it is the crucial and, as I say, the only specifically social virtue of the objectivist morality. Objectivism holds, as you of course know, that justice and not sacrifice should be the ruling principle in human relationships. Justice, to quote Galt, is, quote, the recognition of the fact that you must judge all men as conscientiously as you judge inanimate objects, with the same respect for truth, with the same incorruptible vision, by as pure and as rational a process of identification. That every man must be judged for what he is and treated accordingly. That just as you do not pay a higher price for a rusty chunk of scrap than for a piece of shining metal, a rotter above a hero. Close quote. The immediate protest of the mystic altruist contingent would be, oh no, how cruel and materialistic to judge men as one judges inanimate objects. Well, let's understand the full and exact meaning of such a protest. Since presumably we judge inanimate objects rationally and objectively, the only alternative is to judge men irrationally and non-objectively, to ignore what they are, to disregard their character, in a word, to judge them unjustly. The mystic altruist definition of justice, as opposed to Galt's, would read something like the following. You must not judge men as conscientiously as you judge inanimate objects. Truth is not the only consideration. Higher things may be permitted to cloud your vision. You must not judge men by a pure or a rational process of identification. No man must be judged for what he is. Your treatment of him must bear no relation to his character. You must not value a hero above a rotter. It will hurt the rotter's feelings. To judge men as one judges inanimate objects does not mean to judge them as if they were inanimate objects. It means to judge them by the same epistemology, by the same rules of reason and logic. And that is what the mystic altruists dread. And while they prattle that reason is materialistic and mercy is superior to justice, what their theories mean, in fact, in reality, is that inanimate objects deserve the full focus of man's consciousness, but human beings do not. That inanimate objects deserve the effort of man's rational awareness, of logic, of thought, but human beings do not. That inanimate objects are worthy of justice, but human beings are not. No, of course, this is not what the mystic altruists say, but this is what they practice. As proof, look at mankind's progress in the realm of the material sciences, where reason is the standard for judging inanimate objects. Then look at mankind's brutality, terror, and despair in the moral realm of human relationships, from which reason and justice have been banned. The killer tenet in this issue is the slogan that mercy is superior to justice. Like self-sacrifice, it is a precept that has been smuggled into men's minds by degrees, through the back door, by means of sloppy definitions, woozy generalities, evasions, and emotional package dealing. Just as most people believe that self-sacrifice means nothing more than some vague sort of kindness, like giving dimes to beggars or contributing to charity drives, and do not realize by what steps they are being pushed into a sacrificial furnace, so most people believe that mercy means nothing more than some vague sort of forgiveness toward petty and repentant offenders. But this is not what mercy means. Even among its advocates, few care to admit to themselves or to others what it actually does mean. The example of mercy which its advocates usually offer is as follows. A judge has the power to sentence a young first offender to serve a jail term of from 2 to 10 years, but he considers mitigating circumstances and gives him the shorter rather than the longer term. Most people accept this as an example of mercy, but this is not an act of mercy, it is an act of justice. If there are circumstances mitigating the boy's guilt, it would be unjust to impose on him a punishment heavier than he deserves. It is precisely in order to weigh mitigating circumstances that judges are given latitude in the choice of punishment. A judge who, in this same case, would impose a 10-year sentence, ignoring the evidence in favor of the boy, would not be unmerciful, but unjust. Justice is not arbitrary. It is not a favor. It is not arbitrary kindness, nor arbitrary severity. Justice consists of pronouncing judgment in accordance with all the relevant facts, in accordance with reality. Mercy, on the other hand, is arbitrary. Mercy is a favor. It consists of granting an unearned and undeserved kindness, a kindness contrary to facts and to reality. Mercy consists of kindness superseding reality. If a so-called merciful judge gave the lightest sentence in his power to a hardened criminal, in defiance of all the evidence proving that the man was a monster, that would be mercy. And if a year later a merciful parole board set the criminal free, that would be mercy. And if a month later the criminal murdered 3 people while holding up a store and robbing the cash register of $6.75, that would be the result of mercy. Well, today's law courts and newspapers are full of such instances of mercy. If an employer forgives an employee for an accidental error, the first in 6 months of efficient and conscientious service, that is not mercy, but justice. If an employer keeps forgiving the constant errors of an incompetent employee who does not propose to focus on his work, that is mercy. If you do not know how to judge the character of a person because the facts available to you are insufficient and the evidence of his flaws is inconclusive, you must give him the benefit of the doubt, not on the ground of mercy, but on the ground of justice, because to let off the guilty is less disastrous than to condemn the innocent, because virtues are more important than flaws, because justice demands that a man be considered innocent until proved guilty. And this principle applies in law courts as well as in your personal relationships with people. Except that in personal relationships, when you give the benefit of the doubt, you do not dismiss the case. You wait for further evidence to prove the good or bad character of the person before you pass a moral judgment. Mercy is a concept that applies to and is called upon only by the evil, never by the good. If a man has committed a heroic or virtuous deed, What he asks is justice, not mercy. If a man has committed a despicable or vicious deed, what he dreads is justice, and what he cries for is mercy. The desire for mercy is always the desire to escape from the objective facts of reality. There is the old joke about the friend who looks at the portrait of a woman and says to her, "It's a wonderful portrait that really does you justice," whereupon the woman replies angrily, "I didn't want justice, I wanted mercy." Now I will read to you a dictionary definition of mercy and ask you to listen carefully and observe the implications of the concepts used. It's a good test for you as you listen to this definition of your ability to grasp philosophical implications. This is from the American College Dictionary. Quote, mercy, one, compassion or kindly forbearance shown toward an offender, an enemy, or other person in one's power. Compassion, pity, or benevolence. Two, disposition to be merciful. Three, discretionary power as to clemency or severity, pardon or punishment, or the like. Four, an act of forbearance, compassion, or favor, especially of God toward his creatures. Close quote. Observe two concepts that are central to this definition, guilt and arbitrary power. Guilt is implied by such terms as forbearance, offender, pity, clemency, pardon, punishment. These terms are not applicable to virtue or to innocence. They are applicable only to those who are guilty of some crime or wrong or evil. Arbitrary power is implied by such phrases as an offender, an enemy, or other person in one's power. Discretionary power as to clemency or severity, pardon or punishment. An act of forbearance, compassion, or favor, especially of God toward his creatures. Close quote. What picture of the judged and the judges does this definition project? The judged are wretches who are guilty of evils that deserve punishment, who can hope for kindness only as an undeserved favor. The judges are omnipotent dictators who hold these wretches in their discretionary power, a power akin to God's, and who dispense forbearance, compassion, clemency, pardon, as an arbitrary favor of their arbitrary whim. This is the exact meaning of mercy and the exact motive of those who advocate it, and this is what we are asked to place above justice. Mercy, which you hear extolled as a moral virtue, is an anti-moral concept. It pertains to and implies moral anarchy, a view of existence where moral values are inoperative, where men's fate is not determined by their virtues or vices, and men need not consider the consequences of their actions, since virtues may not necessarily bring rewards and vices may not necessarily bring punishment, since causality may be suspended by a power superior to moral principles. The power of the arbitrary whim of who? Well, whoever gets himself into the position of ruler over men willing to live at his mercy. Now, the logical question to ask yourselves is this: who would have a vested interest in upholding this sort of view? Who would have reason to long for an escape from morality and to hope that a deserved retribution may somehow be diverted from his head? Only the man who is guilty and intends to remain guilty. Only the man who has committed evil and intends to continue committing evil. Mercy is a blank check on and a license to evil. As in the case of any other vicious, irrational concept, The men who uphold mercy long for both sides of the coin and see themselves in both roles, as the judged and the judges, as the recipients and as the dispensers of unearned favors. They expect a chance to be in both positions according to where they might land in the future, a chance to dispense the undeserved to groveling wretches as insurance against the day when it will be their turn to grovel. Judge not that ye be not judged. Now who has no interest in this view of existence? Whose interests are not included in the concept of mercy? Who is eloquently absent from the definition of mercy that I read? The innocent and the virtuous. They are the men who do not need mercy, but who do need justice. It is the men of innocence and the men of virtue who need acknowledgement and recognition, who need to be treated for what they are, who need no favors, only the justice of receiving that which they have earned and deserved, that which is theirs by right. These are the men whose existence the concept of mercy blanks out. There is a reason for that blank out. All evils are committed against men, not against physical nature or inanimate objects. You cannot be evil toward a table, a chair, or a chunk of stone, only toward a human being. Every act of evil has victims. And if one is to give an undeserved benefit, any kind of undeserved benefit, to an evildoer, one has to take it away from his victims. One has to do it at the expense of his victims. Consider this carefully. There is no exception to this rule. For instance, if a man steals $100, is caught, and the judge orders him to return $80, but out of mercy allows him to keep $20, it is from the victim of the theft that these $20 are taken. Now, this, of course, is the simplest example, but it is the exact and irrevocable pattern of any act of mercy. The principle involved is an absolute, and what obscures it is the fact that most of the actual instances of mercy are much more complex, and therefore the harm of the victims is not as directly immediately perceivable. What obscures it further is the fact that the injustice involves spiritual as well as material benefits granted to the guilty at the expense of the innocent. Justice is a moral principle. All moral principles deal with values by which one guides one's choices and actions. Moral values determine our evaluations of our fellow men, their importance to us, and our attitude and policies toward them. Take the example I cited earlier of the judge who was merciful toward a criminal, which resulted in the murder of three innocent victims. To be merciful, the judge had to drop the context of the man's crime, ignore the harm which the man had done his victims, and be concerned only with the man's interest, forgetting the interests of his victims. Whether the judge intended it consciously or not, his action meant, in fact, that he considered the criminal important but the victims unimportant. That the undeserved concern he granted to the criminal reduced by that exact degree the concern he owed to the victims. That in terms of moral appraisal, he evaluated the criminal as more than the man actually was by means of evaluating the victims as less than they actually were. The first spiritual consequence of this injustice is the bitterness and disillusionment of the victims, who would rightfully feel that the light penalty imposed on the criminal for the heavy injury he had done to them meant that the society of their fellow men, by the verdict of the judge as society's representative, did not care about them, the victims, did not consider them important, did not choose to defend them. They would feel it necessarily, whether they identified it consciously or not, because such were the facts and such is the nature of the feeling of any man who has ever suffered an injustice. This feeling is the start or the confirmation of that sense of hopelessness and suspicion which most men feel toward one another. Hopelessness in regard to ever finding justice or fairness. suspicion in regard to always watching out for unexpected, unprovoked injury or malice. Such is the first consequence of the judge's mercy, and the manner in which the spiritual benefit of the guilty is granted at the expense of the innocent. The undeserved pleasure of the criminal at his light sentence, the feeling of, I got away with it, and the undeserved pain of the victims, the feeling of moral loneliness, of the feeling, there's nobody to defend me. The ultimate consequence of the judge's mercy is the murder of the three innocent men by the released criminal. It is not an accidental consequence. Whether any evader, such as that judge, chooses to think of it or not, every value judgment reflects a moral principle. And a principle is an abstraction that applies to a countless number of concretes. And there are no out-of-context judgments, because the full context of any situation continues to exist in reality, whether any evader had dropped it or not. Therefore, by his action, the judge had upheld, declared, and put into reality the principle that the good is to be subordinated and sacrificed to the evil. It is only a matter of time and degree until this principle leads to its ultimate consequences. And it is of no importance whether the three murdered victims were three new persons or the same men whom the criminal had victimized earlier. What is important is that all the victims were concrete representatives of the same moral abstraction which the judge's mercy had ignored and sacrificed. They were innocent men. It is not revenge that the victims of evil need, but moral support. The sense that their fellow men stand by them, take seriously an offense against them, and punish it severely. It is the sense of living in a moral society. The meaning of imposing on a criminal a punishment commensurate with the seriousness of his crime is not just to make him suffer, though he deserves it, but to give an objective, factual expression to the moral principle that the evil are not to benefit by their evil. That no man may violate the rights of another with impunity. That the physical and spiritual consequences of evil are to be borne by the evildoer, not by his victims. And that a society of moral men will not go by in passive indifference and let the victims absorb the pain which the criminal has caused them and which is often irreparable. Let me illustrate the proceeding in the following way. Suppose that some drunken driver, say an irresponsible playboy with political connections, runs over your child and kills him in an accident caused by wanton deliberate negligence. He shows no regret or repentance, has no mitigating excuses to offer, but is let off without punishment due to his political connections. You will feel a just and terrible indignation against the courts and against society in general. If then you discover one day that your best friend is running around with that playboy, will you be able to continue the friendship? Or will you feel that if he valued you at all, he would never tolerate the man who caused you so profound a suffering? You would drop your friend, of course, and the bitter indignation you would feel against him is the feeling of being let down, abandoned, denied the moral solidarity one had expected and deserved, which is experienced by all victims of unpunished evils on a personal and social scale. An unpunished wrong is a shrug of indifference at the pain of the right. And this is the kind of social poison that every act of mercy to an evildoer spreads through a society. If goodwill among men is a desirable social state, then no such goodwill is possible if men lose respect for the moral caliber of their fellow men. If they come to regard one another not as well-meaning friends, but as amoral, indifferent cynics. The collapse of moral standards is necessarily to the disadvantage of the good men and to the advantage of the evil. Such are the spiritual consequences of mercy to criminals: the discouragement and disillusionment of the virtuous element in people, the encouragement of the vicious element. The practical physical consequences are obvious. Mercy is a license to further evil, as you can read in terms of the results clearly in any newspaper. Now, if you understand the workings of mercy, consider a few more examples. If you succumb to pleas for mercy toward juvenile delinquents, what is your moral injustice toward the victims they have robbed or murdered, toward the families, the friends, and all those who had loved those victims? How much concern do you give them? How lightly do you evaluate their pain? To what embittered loneliness are you willing to abandon them? Or, if you hear pleas for mercy toward communists and Nazis, toward men who had heard or evaded the screams of millions of innocent victims that had been tortured in concentration camps, torture chambers, and gas chambers, and had seen or evaded the blood of those victims on their own hands, if you hear pleas for mercy for such people, whether in the form of an action or merely in the form of spiritual kindness, just a touch of pity in your soul to replace the merciless loathing they deserve, what moral injustice are you willing to commit toward those victims? Would you be able to feel that pity while visualizing clearly, fully, and specifically those torture cellars, the blood, the screams, the twisted bodies, and the distorted faces of the victims? No, you couldn't? Then that is the proof I wanted to give you, that one can feel pity or mercy for the guilty only at the price of ignoring, evading, and forgetting the fate of the innocent. That any undeserved benefit of the evil is granted at the expense of the good. This last is especially relevant today when one hears so many pleas for kindness or, quote, understanding, close quote, toward communists. And what is blanked out by these apostles of humanitarianism who plea for this kindness or mercy, what is blanked out is the amount of blood morally on the hands of any adult human being sympathetic to communism in the modern world. What is blanked out is how many million victims at this point. That is what has to be evaded totally in order to talk about kindness or mercy toward the sympathizers with dictatorships. You can now appreciate more fully the meaning of Reardon's thoughts in the following passage from Atlas Shrugged, quote, "When one acts on pity against justice, it is the good whom one punishes for the sake of the evil. When one saves the guilty from suffering, it is the innocent whom one forces to suffer. There is no escape from justice. Nothing can be unearned and unpaid for in the universe, neither in matter nor in spirit. And if the guilty do not pay, then the innocent have to pay it." Close quote. Such is the meaning of mercy, the penalizing of virtue for being virtue, the rewarding of vice for being vice, the sacrifice of the good to the evil. And such is the full meaning of the slogan that mercy is superior to justice. A symptom of the degree to which this monstrous doctrine has permeated our culture is the fact that most people think of justice only as an issue pertaining to law courts, to criminals, to the punishment of evil, to dealing with negatives. And few people ever think of justice toward the good. Yet that is the primary moral purpose and meaning of justice. Justice consists of acknowledging the good, not merely of denouncing the evil, of rewarding virtue, not merely of punishing vice, of fostering the positive, not merely of stopping the negative. What, after all, is justice in relationship to the basic standard of man's life? Why is justice a cardinal virtue? Because justice is the policy of rewarding those actions of men which are pro-life and of condemning or penalizing those actions of men which are anti-life, of supporting, complimenting, encouraging, praising that which is good, meaning that which is conducive to, contributory to, in accordance with man's survival condemning, punishing, denouncing that which is inimical to man's life and survival. And justice is not the monopoly of law courts. Law courts are only its final expression and result. Its source and practice is in the moral judgments of individual men, and these moral judgments determine the kind of law courts men will get. In his relation with others, every man must be a judge, a moral judge, a function the mystics and altruists have good reason to fear. And justice, not mercy, must be your standard of appraisal, which means that you must judge every man for what he is and treat him accordingly. You must regard the act of your moral appraisal as solemnly as the strictest, most honorable judge regards his responsibility in a court of law, and you must carry out the verdicts you pass. Your moral approval or disapproval is your only means of rewarding virtue and punishing evil, and it is a much more potent weapon than most of you probably suspect. Not only will it bring pleasure or pain, support or discouragement to those you meet in person, and if you are just, will have importance for both the good men and the evil, but the standard of justice in a whole society will be determined by those who have the courage and accept the responsibility of passing moral judgments. If today we live in an age of outrageous injustice, it is because the mystic altruists are setting the moral standards and the better men are keeping silent. Therefore, in place of the slogan, "Judge not that ye be not judged," objectivism answers, "Judge and be prepared to be judged." And more, be prepared to be judged for your judgments. Because one of the solemn responsibilities entailed in the act of passing moral judgments, and one of the reasons why most men are frightened to pass them, is precisely because any third person is then able to look at your judgment, and to look at the object of your judgment, and to judge you on the basis of the kind of judgment you have passed. And that is precisely the responsibility which many men dread. The recognition, the acknowledgement, the loyalty, the admiration which you owe to those who deserve such responses, to men of virtue and achievement, are a much more important act of justice than the mere condemnation of evil. The positive is always much more important than the negative. It is much more important to express in action, to translate into reality, your admiration for John Galt than your contempt for Wesley Mouch. But, by the same token, you must never fail to express your contempt for Wesley Mouch and never soften it with any mercy, because if you do, that is an act of treason to Galt and to all the men of virtue in the world. If you feel concern for suffering, be concerned first with the suffering of the virtuous, with the suffering of a genius, with the suffering of a Hank Reardon, and give thought to relieving it before you start worrying about the suffering of the village idiot or of James Taggart. There can be no darker immorality and injustice than the idea that the men of greatness, of ability, of achievement deserve no concern by reason of their greatness, ability, and achievement, and that the mediocrities deserve concern by reason of their mediocrity. That is the penalizing of virtue for being virtue. It is the virtue of justice that represents the most profound cleavage between the objectivist ethics and the mystic altruist collectivist axis. Justice is the concept they cannot accept or touch or approach, not any inch or part of it, because the whole of the altruist collectivist doctrine rests on injustice to human ability and achievement, rests on the concepts of mercy, charity, expropriation, rests on the necessity of unpaid supporters, unrewarded producers, unacknowledged keepers of, and sacrificial animals to, the weaknesses, flaws, defaults, and depravities of their brothers. Justice is the concept which the altruist collectivists ignore, evade, blank out, and squirm to escape, as in medieval legends, the devil was supposed to squirm at the sight of holy water.